Continuing the readings from the chapter called Unsupported and Unsupportive Consciousness, we just had the passage from the Rohitasa Sutta. The Buddha had this conversation with a deva who had been trying to walk to the end of the world. Both Rohitasa and the errant monk in the tale the Buddha told to Kevada have been looking in the wrong way and in the wrong place, looking for finality in samsara, which is endlessness itself. As Ajahn Chah would put it, if you're looking for security in that which is inherently insecure, if you're looking for satisfaction in that which is incapable of satisfying, you are bound to suffer. Lumpur Cha was extraordinarily gifted in these very brief, clear, and insightful Dhamma statements. Like, oh yes, of course. In his manner of speaking to Rohitasa and also in the Kevada Sutta, the Buddha shifts the perspective to the other side of the border, as it were, and speaks from the point of view of the unconditioned mind. The problem is not in the nature of the sense world, the problem is the habit of taking it to be the ultimate reality. So taking the sense world to be something fundamentally substantial, solid, real, permanent, and so forth. Here are some related passages from other places in the Pali Canon and from some of the Thai forest meditation masters. And this first quotation is from the first chapter of the Udana, the Buddha's inspired utterances. Where water, earth, fire and wind have no footing, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, the moon does not appear, darkness is not found. And when a sage, a worthy one, through wisdom, has known this for themselves, then, from form and name, from pleasure and pain, they are freed. So again, that form and name, that's rupa and nama, that was a subject that we were looking at in the previous readings. It can mean mind and body, materiality and mentality, even subject and object, in Rhys David's rendering of Neumann. And when it talks about being freed from form and name, from rupa and nama, just as we were talking about cessation of consciousness or where they are destroyed, it's to be understood that it's not a kind of blanking out or going unconscious or the whole sensory world disappearing, but it's that withdrawal of the false sense of substantiality, the false sense of solidity and permanence and thingness that the mind habitually gives to what we see and hear and smell, taste, touch, and think about. And then this next quotation is from the Sutta Nipata, and I'll read this a bit more extensively from Dr. Saratisa's translation. So this is from Sutta Nipata, verses 873 to 874. Someone is asking the Buddha, to one endowed in what manner does form, rupa, cease to exist? And the Buddha responds, one who is neither of normal perception nor of abnormal perception, one who is neither non-percipient nor who has put an end to perception. It is to one who is thus constituted that form ceases to pertain, for reckonings characterized by conceptual proliferation have perceptions as their source. So that's reckonings characterized by conceptual proliferation, papancha. We've talked about it in previous readings, that habit of the mind of running off with one associated thought after another, after another, after another. And in that verse, it's highlighted that the source of papancha is sanya, is perception. So how the mind takes hold of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, remembering, imagining. It doesn't just see it and know it as it is, but it takes a perception and then elaborates and proliferates around it. So, before going on, I thought to read that section from the Sutta Nipata. This is Dr. Saditissa's rendering of the Sutta Nipata. He was teaching at the university, I think in Toronto, for some time. And he did this translation of the Sutta Nipata mostly for his Western students in Canada. And so it's quite a liberal rendering. And some people have criticized this particular translation as being inaccurate or not perfectly true to the Pali, but Dr. Saratisa had two doctorates in Pali studies, so He was extremely knowledgeable and skilled in the Pali language. And so he's put this into a form that is quite readable and comprehensible, relatable, easy to relate to for a Western audience. So this is called the...
He was the monk who Ajahn Chah told Lumbasamedho to relate to in the same way as the Sangharaja.
That's true, yes. Because he was the head of the London Buddhist Vihara for many years. When I first came back to England as a monk in 1979, then he was the senior bhikkhu in this country and was very significant in our community. And when we had the first ordinations of Lumpho Sumato's bhikkhu disciples in October of 1979, it was Dr. Saratissa was the preceptor, and the ordination was held on a boat on the River Thames. We had a water seamer, water boundary, so we had to wait till the tide came in and the boat was lifted off the riverbed, and then we could have the Upasampada. It was a very memorable first week in England as a bhikkhu. So this is called the Kalaha Vivada Sutta, Disputes and Contention. I'll read the whole of this because it's got a lot of useful material in it. The subtitle is The Causes of Anger and Attachment. "Sir," said a questioner, "whenever there are arguments and quarrels, there are tears and anguish, arrogance and pride, and grudges and insults to go with them. Can you explain how these things come about? Where do they all come from?" The Buddha responds, "The tears and anguish that follow arguments and quarrels," said the Buddha, "the arrogance and pride and the grudges and insults that go with them are all the result of one thing. They come from having preferences, from holding things precious and dear. Insults are born out of arguments and grudges, are inseparable from quarrels." "But why, sir, do we have these preferences, these special things? Why do we have so much greed? And are all the aspirations and achievements that we base our lives on, where do we get them from?" "The preferences, the precious things," said the Buddha, "come from the impulse of desire. So too does the greed, and so too do the aspirations and achievements that make up people's lives." And the question asks, "From where, sir, comes this impulse of desire? From where do we derive our theories and opinions? And what about all the other things that you, the wanderer, have named, such as anger, dishonesty, and confusion?" The Buddha responds, "The impulse of desire arises when people think of one thing as pleasant and another as unpleasant. That's the source of desire. It's when people see the material things are subject both to becoming and to disintegration that they form their theories about the world. Anger, confusion, and dishonesty arise when things are set in pairs as opposites. The person with perplexity must train himself in the path of knowledge. The recluse has declared the truth after realization." And the questioner asks again, "But why, sir, is it that we find some things pleasant and some unpleasant?" So he's going from tanha, from craving to feeling, and down through the whole dependent origination sort of sequence, if you had noticed. "Why, sir, is it that we find some things pleasant and some unpleasant? What could we do to stop that? And this idea of becoming and disintegration, could you explain where that comes from?" "It is the action of contact, of mental impression, that leads to the feelings of pleasant and unpleasant. Without contact, they would not exist. And, as I see it, the idea of becoming and disintegration also comes from this source, from the action of contact." "So, what, sir, what does this contact come from? And the grasping habit, what's the reason for that? Is there anything that can be done to get rid of possessiveness, and anything that could be eliminated so that there would be no more contact?" The Buddha responds, "Contact exists because the compound of mind and matter exists, nama and rupa. The habit of grasping is based on wanting things. If there were no wanting, there would be no possessiveness. Similarly, without the element of form, of matter, there would be no contact." And there's the question, "What pursuit leads a person to get rid of form? And how can suffering and pleasure cease to exist? This is what I want to know about." And then this is the quotation that I read in the other translation. The Buddha responds, "There is a state where form ceases to exist," said the Buddha. "It is a state without ordinary perception and without disordered perception, and without no perception and without any annihilation of perception. It is perception, consciousness, that is the source of all basic obstacles." So you've explained to us everything that we've asked you about. There is one more question we'd like you to answer for us. Do the learned scholars of the world say that this is the highest purification of the individual being, or do they say that there is some other kind of goal? "There are scholars and authorities," replied the Buddha, "who say that this is the highest purification of the individual. There are others who maintain that the highest purity is to be found in the complete eradication of the five components of the person." It's the five khandhas. "And there is also the Muni, the wise man. He has realized which things are dependencies, and he knows that these are only crutches and props. And when he's realized this, he has become free. He does not enter into arguments, and so does not enter the round of endless becomings." There's a lot in that, but it's a relatable and a quite fluid expression of some of the causal process of how the mind gets lost in its perceptions, in its judgments, preferences, and how arguments and conflicts arise, and how it traces it back to perception and attachment to vijnana, consciousness of various types. And at the very end there, the Buddha was talking about, when he says the Muni, the wise man, he's talking about his own view, his own understanding as well, that the things which are dependencies, he knows these are only crutches and props, so anything that's formed, conditioned, and structured. When he has realized this, he has become free, so that the mind is not taking its stand upon any construction, any condition, any opinion, whether it's an eternalist opinion or a nihilistic opinion, and so on and so forth. His last sentence there is, "He does not enter into arguments, and so does not enter the round of endless becomings." Speaking about papancha, one of the characteristics of the Buddha was nipapancha, one who is free of complications, free of proliferations. So even though the Buddha had extraordinarily broad range of knowledge and experience, understanding, an incredible mind that had a vast range of capacities and the memory and access to a huge range of knowledge, he was also uncomplicated. the nipapancha, that the heart being free of complication, even though there's a lot of material, a vast range of experience, still the abiding quality or characteristic of the Buddha was nipapancha, one who was uncomplicated and not drawn into those realms of proliferation and that sort of diversification. Any comments or reflections on that?
I think it is helpful drawing attention to the nipapancha, because oftentimes driven by the desire or idea, if we could just figure it out, and so often it's just more proliferation, being able to settle the mind, still the mind, and reflect, and using the discernment quality of the mind. Very important.
One of the most helpful and profound statements of the Buddha is, whatever you conceive it to be, the truth is always other than that. So the reality is inconceivable. It can't be put into a form or a conception. And just that simple principle, it counteracts that urge to figure everything out, get it all pinned down, and to try and lock the nature of reality into our sort of conceptual forms. That the Buddha very simply, very directly says, whatever you conceive it to be, the truth is always other than that. And it's not because you haven't got enough information. It's not that you need more data, then we would really know. And that's, I think, one of the primary drives of the Western world, particularly in the scientific realm, to figure everything out. And if they just do more research and do a few more studies, and then finally we'll get to the bottom of how it all works. When I was a student many years ago, I had a professor of immunology, Ivan Reut was his name, and he really rejoiced in the fact that we're never going to figure it out. And he would say, you know, when you're trying to research some kind of immunological process, you can figure out how stages 1 to 5 work, or stages 6 to 11 work, but to get from stage 5 to stage 6 is completely impossible. I remember being in the lecture theatre when he says something like, well, it's not impossible, but it should only be able to occur at 400 degrees Celsius and at 200 atmospheres pressure, and it's a reaction that should take several hours, but our body does it instantaneously all the time, and it can't. And he kind of lit up with this sort of like, this is completely impossible, and we have no way of explaining how we do this, and we do it all the time. Another of the things he pointed out, so when you're trying to work out the experiments that you run and the studies you do to figure out that one mysterious link, even if you figure that out, you uncover another dozen mysteries and impossible things along the way. So you never get to the bottom of it. And he rejoiced in that bottomlessness of scientific knowledge. Many scientists don't, but I think it's a kind of Western conceit that has been very dominant. It won't be long before we figured it all out and we can understand exactly how the universe works. It's also interesting to me that in 1895, Harvard University shut down their graduate physics department. They closed the graduate school because they thought they understood everything. 1895. There's just two little mysterious things they couldn't quite explain. Radioactivity, and I think it was then the radiation of light from heated bodies. That was when we get those two figured out, then we'll be fine. Along came Einstein. Oops. And the theory of relativity. So we do tend to have that conceit. And even though that might seem kind of remote, in the meditation hall, in the quietness of our own practice, our minds can still be quite busy trying to nail it down in terms of a plan, a concept, getting a map, and a description. And that simple reflection of the Buddha's, whatever you conceive it to be, the truth is always other than that. It keeps reminding us that any kind of judgment has to be conditional. It's only an approximation. And kind of useful, convenient fiction, they're approximations. And that's all we need. And so the Buddha's guidance and encouragement is to not try and nail everything down conceptually, but to use knowledge, understanding, information as a prop, as a bridge, and understanding it just to be that, not looking at it to be an end in itself or something that is absolutely true and real. So any questions, thoughts? Yes?
What you were saying about the sort of Western scientific project, the story of Rohitasa, this skywalker trying to walk across the world, initially seems very remote. But then if you imagine that as a metaphor for the modern scientific project, right there, yes. How much energy went into putting human beings on the moon, or that particle accelerator down in France, and you realize, yeah.
What? Switzerland.
It goes all out of the country, so you could say it's in France.
Oh, it goes across the border. Okay, there you go. You weren't incorrect. Yeah.
So, yeah.
What are borders anyway?
Especially when it's doing particles.
Can I just say maybe a little bit in defense of scientists? I think it's more about how scientific research is presented. Because generally, scientific community as such, at least physics, I can sort of speak a little bit from experience, people know that they know very little or nothing. And the consensus, especially people who do things like quantum mechanics, which is most proved and, useful theory, nobody knows what is actually going on. They once made in one of their big conferences, one of these scientific conferences, they actually done a poll. They're trying to figure out if people agree what is underlying philosophy, if you want, of quantum mechanics, and they couldn't agree. It was 10 different cases. So basically nobody knows why it works, but maths works and it's good enough. So I think scientific community is not very good at conveying, what's actually going on. And because if you don't have first-hand information, it's very easy, somebody presented to you, scientists, to be like this, really people who works only with limited data. Mm-hmm. So it's just to defend.
No, I think that's fine. I think the landscape has changed quite a bit in more recent times. But I would say that there's not a universal sort of arrogance or conceit. I remember seeing the physicist Richard Feynman. I've seen it quoted many times where he said, anyone who claims that they understand quantum mechanics is lying.
Yeah.
And he literally wrote the textbook on it.
Yeah, it's called black body radiation.
What's that?
The theory you were mentioning is called black body radiation, which was...
Black body radiation. Yeah, thank you.
It's led to particle wave duality, idea of particle wave duality, because you can't explain it using the idea of light as a wave. You have to come to idea that light is a wave and the particle at the same time.
Yeah, I've come across the word wavical in the past. Anyway, to continue, we now go to Lumpo Cha's biography, Stillness Flowing, written by Venerable Ajahn Jayasaro. Lumpo Cha continued on his wanderings, looking for peaceful places to practice, until one day he reached Ban Kokiao, where he came across a deserted monastery about half a kilometre from the edge of the hamlet, a little village. His mind felt light and tranquil. It was as if there was a kind of gathering of forces. And this is Lumpo Cha giving his own description of that experience. One night there was a festival on in the village. Sometime after 11 o'clock, while I was walking Jonkrom, doing walking meditation, I began to feel rather strange. In fact, this feeling, an unusual kind of calmness and ease, had first appeared during the day. When I became weary from walking, I went into the small grass-roofed hut to sit and was taken by surprise. Suddenly my mind desired tranquility so intensely that I could hardly cross my legs quickly enough. It just happened by itself. Almost immediately the mind did indeed become peaceful. It felt firm and stable. It wasn't that I couldn't hear the sounds of merrymaking in the village. I could still hear them. But if I wished to, I could not hear them. It was strange. When I paid no attention to the sounds, there was silence. If I wanted to hear them, I could, and felt no irritation. Within my mind, it was as if there were two objects standing there together, but with no connection between them. I saw the mind and its sense object established in different areas, like a kettle and a spittoon placed by a monk's seat. I realized that if concentration is still weak, you hear sounds, but when the mind is empty, then it's silent. If a sound arises and you look at the awareness of it, you see that the awareness is separate from the sound. I reflected, well, how else could it be? That's just the way it is. They're unconnected. I kept considering this point until I realized, this is important. When continuity, santati in the Pali, between things is broken, then there is peace, santi. Formerly there had been santati, continuity, and now, from it, had emerged santi, peacefulness. I continued with my meditation. My mind was completely indifferent to all external phenomena. That's a very well-known incident from Lumpo Cha's teachings. In the large biography that Ajahn Jayasaro spent many years putting together, you can find that passage and more of it. It's on pages 90 and 91 of the Stillness Flowing, if you want to look for more of that account. Any thoughts or comments on that from...
It's just always beautiful to remember.
So that is a very strong theme within the forest tradition. And sometimes people, particularly Abhidhamma scholars, there's often a kind of a disagreement or that sense of you can't meaningfully talk about the awareness being separate from its objects in some aspects of Abhidhamma, as I have heard. But it's Lumpo Cha's experience, he's describing it there, and a theme presented by other Ajahns in the forest tradition in particular, that is a core element of Dhamma practice, is that the awareness is one quality and the objects of awareness is another. It's also in Lumpo Cha's accounts of the brief time he spent with Lumpu Mun I only spent 3 days with him, but I think it was the Dhamma talk that Lumpu Man gave on the third evening. That was a point that he made in his teachings, that the mind that knows is one quality and the objects of awareness are another. And if there wasn't some kind of capacity for a quality of knowing to be separate from its objects, then liberation would be impossible. But because there's a quality of awareness, a quality of knowing that can be completely free of limitation or identification with the objects of awareness, that's why liberation is possible for us. And when the young Ajahn Chah, I think he was about 7 or 8 vasa?
We would be in 7 or 8, yeah.
About 7 or 8 reigns as a monk.
Too long time.
That had a really big impact on him. When he heard that, it's like, you know, the lights came on. It's like, oh, of course. It was just clearly obvious. And it was something he hadn't really seen or hadn't really sunk in a profound and complete way. But as he said in various different talks, different expressions, or he said that really changed his view of the Dhamma practice, and it gave him a very clear, definite direction for his practice from that time onwards. Any thoughts, questions?
How old was he then?
Well, if he was 7 or 8 vasa, he became a bhikkhu when he was 20, so he'd be 27, 28-ish, less than 30.
So I just want to make sure that I understood what you said regarding the mind and the object of awareness, so that makes possible freedom from the attachments. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a quality of awareness. When that awakened awareness is completely free of identification or grasping attachment to objects, then that is the quality of mind that we can say is, that is what can be liberated. And when we practice insight meditation, it's the cultivation of that quality of awareness that's not attached to, identified with, or limited by what it knows. Mostly, the knowing faculty is thoroughly locked onto what we think, what we see, what we hear, smell, taste, touch, and so on. And Lumpu Cha would say, it's like if you have a bottle with oil and water, it's like the oil and the water are shaken up together, and so it looks like one liquid. But if you put the bottle down, then the oil and the water, the knowing and its objects, they separate out from each other. So it was the way he would talk about that, letting go of sense objects or the mind's perceptions, and of freeing that quality of awareness from its habit of identification and being mixed up with.
So by cultivating awareness, then we can contribute to our detachment, right?
Absolutely. That's the main gain, I would say. Any comments or thoughts on it?
It was a point that Ajahn Mun emphasized, and it comes up in many of the other forest masters refer to that as being, of course, Ajahn Chah, we're very familiar with that, but many of the other forest Ajahns that are disciples of Ajahn Mun would talk about that as being a central piece of his instruction and encouragement.
So it's important that having the idea of that, awareness is separate from his objects, but the idea is not awareness itself. That makes sense.
Can I give an example?
Sure.
Okay, so I'm going to the garden center, and I like flowers, and every time I find a possibility to buy new flowers. So how can I be touching on buying any more flowers? It's real. I'm struggling with this at the moment. I'm not sure if it's an attachment. I don't know if it's a satisfaction, it gives me satisfaction, it is an attachment. I like flowers, but I need to stop buying flowers.
Got no more room left in your apartment.
They garden flowers mostly. Yeah, so it's a real problem. I can't see if I'm right or wrong. I can't work out yet, is it a satisfaction? Do I need the satisfaction from buying flowers? Or is it an attachment? I don't know, I can't differentiate it. I think my mind is not clear enough to detach of buying flowers.
It sounds quite like an attachment, from my biased opinion. So if you're in the garden center and there's that feeling of, ooh, look at those, they're beautiful.
Mm.
I really want those. Then if we're If we're practicing Dhamma, if we're embodying that quality of awareness, then there's the recognition of, in this moment, here's the, ooh, those are beautiful, I'd like to have those feeling. That's what has arisen. And there's the recognition that that's a mental formation, that's an event that's happened in the mind. Doesn't mean you have to follow it or believe in it or do anything with it, but the mind that knows, here is a feeling of, ooh, aren't those beautiful, I'd love to have those. That's what that feeling is. If there isn't that quality of awareness or the clarity, then we buy into the content. We don't see the process of a thought or a desire arising. We get lost in the content of that thought. So in the development of insight, vipassana meditation, it's training the heart, the mind, to know that the process of desiring, and to see that as a mental event, appearing, disappearing in the mind, rather than something that has to be bought into. A story I often tell, my very first day at Wapananachat, as a sort of scruffy hippie off the beach, I knew nothing about Buddhism, I knew nothing about meditation, and I was entrusted to Anagarika Peter Hazel from Brisbane, to sort of sort me out of Kuti and to give me some basic guidance of how the monastery ran and so on. It was the observance day, so there was going to be a meditation and a Dhamma talk in the evening. And so I was asking about meditation and Buddhism generally. I knew nothing. He was from Australia, so he had an Australian accent. And he said, desire is a liar. My bad Australian accent. Not a lawyer, a liar. He said, the mind tells you, you've got to have something, and we keep following that. Like, I've got to have these plants. The Buddha's teaching is that desire is a liar and that we don't have to follow that. I've been trying to figure out through my teens and childhood how it was possible for us as human beings to be free, because I struggled a lot with desire, that if you get what you want, then it makes you happy for a while, but then it becomes boring. And if you don't get what you want, then you're frustrated and bored already. So how can we always be satisfied? How can we find the quality of freedom and satisfaction? So I've been kind of struggling with these thoughts for years. And so when Anagarika Peter said that, I thought, well, that doesn't really help very much. And I just thought, well, the Buddha doesn't sound like a very impressive person at all. But I was staying there, I just arrived, so I thought, well, okay, I'll give it a try. And also, I was just introduced to the idea that monasteries don't have any food in the evening. That was news to me as well. So anyway, there I was sitting in the sala at Wapananachat, and started to feel hungry. And I'd been living on the beach in Phuket on an extremely tight budget. So most of my diet was pineapple, which was extremely cheap in Phuket. 1 baht for a piece of pineapple. So I thought, oh, I'm hungry, I'd like some pineapple. Okay, he said, so watch the desire. Okay, here's the desire, I want some pineapple. I haven't got any, this is frustrating. How is this supposed to help? The Buddha's stupid. That was my conclusion. Right, I'm still hungry, haven't got any pineapple, it's a desire, I'm watching it. This isn't doing any good at all. Then, 5 or 10 minutes later, after numerous distractions, trying to get somewhere near my breath to follow the rhythm of breathing, then I realized, oh, that desire for the pineapple has gone. My mind was on other things. The feeling of hunger wasn't there, and the desire was gone. And then it hit me. Oh, I didn't get the pineapple, and nothing is missing. Oh, that's what he meant. Desire is a liar. Because when there's a desire, like, I've got to have these plants, I've got to have some pineapple. If you believe that, then there's something missing in your life. If you just watch that desire come and go, that was the insight that hit me that evening. And it was a very confused 21-year-old. Straight off the beach. Oh, I didn't get any pineapple and nothing is missing. Oh. And that was really the first time that had that kind of dynamic. And I realized, oh, the Buddha was very smart. That's what he meant. Oh, right. Well, this is really interesting. So that was really why I stayed in the monastery and I've been here ever since. It was essentially that very insight. For you, it's around plants for your garden. But it's every kind of object that the mind can desire or fear or be irritated by or have an opinion about. So that's the linchpin of the Buddha's teaching, that we can know the feeling of wanting or fearing or hating, and we can watch it arise and watch it pass away. It can tell you when it's present, something is missing, or I can't stand being with this person, or I've got to get X, Y, Z, or I won't be happy. And without suppressing that, without adding anything to it, like talking about perceptions, then that mind can know that feeling, I've got to have, or I can't stand. And it arises, passes away. And when it's gone, that thing that's irritating hasn't gone away, but it's not a problem. The thing that we were desiring, we haven't got it, but there's nothing missing. So what you're describing is really the key piece. So that awareness is that capacity of the citta, the heart, and the mind, to know that wave of desire, or can be fear, or aversion, or an opinion, or all kinds of jealousy, or excitement, any kind of state, that can know that without suppressing it, without identifying with it. And that's the capacity that we have as human beings, to train the mind, the heart, to embody that kind of awareness. Doesn't make us dissociated or spaced out or incapable of acting. It mysteriously, it makes us much more able to function harmoniously with our life and with the world around us. So keep working on that. Any comments or thoughts? Oh, you were there at Nanachat when I showed up.
Yes.
Indeed.
Yes.
So.
I remember you in your kind of ripped Camel Cigarettes t-shirt.
That's right. I was so ragged when I became an Anagarika, and I sort of gave my lay clothes to the lay people. They didn't want them. They were too scruffy, even for the Bungwai villagers. So I was a pretty ragged hippie.
Going back to the awareness and knowing, how we, or should we disassociate from when we are in the environment, a conducive environment? For example, listening to a good Dharma talk, a summer day, a good group of Dharma friends. We know that it's good, but then how, just to see how this associate with the
Well, even the wholesome and the noble, if the mind attaches to it and clings to it, it's going to be a cause of suffering. Being with good people, a crowd of interested Dhamma friends on a beautiful spring day, if the mind grasps that, it turns it into a headache very easily. Oh, it was so good last Sunday, I hope it's going to be like that next Sunday. If you seek for security in that which is insecure, you're bound to suffer. I was quoting Lumbhachara at the beginning. So we can recognize that things are delightful or wholesome or gladdening to the heart. Yes, but wholesome and noble things, if they're attached to or identified with or owned, the mind grasps us, then it becomes a source of dukkha right there. It's like in Venerable Ajahn Mun's Ballad of Liberation for the Five Khandhas, one of the passages from it is, wanting what's good without stop, that's a disease of the mind.
I think it's also important to recognize that the solution is not wanting, in the sense of pushing any kind of recognition, trying to flatten every experience out, so that you're somehow in some idealized form of me being the knower. There's still a recognition of what's beautiful, what's not beautiful, what's pleasant, what's not pleasant. But I think it's also tempered with wisdom so that one recognizes what is useful and what is not useful, what's beneficial and not beneficial, what is skillful and what's not skillful. Those are more the categories that one is paying attention to, because something can be very beautiful and also be skillful. Like, this is a far more beautiful hall than the old one. And you put a lot of more effort and attention into making it happen, and it's incredibly skillful. The benefit is going to be for, you know, hundreds of years, really.
Hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. If it doesn't burn down, they don't let you know.
So what Lumpur Sana was saying about sometimes there can be a kind of enthusiastic idea. Oh, yeah, being the knowing, that's it. Lumpur Sumedho was explaining that. I'm just going to be the knowing. And you create this kind of idea of embodying this abstracted, aware thing that then you become out of harmony with all the people around you. You become a real pain in the neck, essentially. You're trying to be detached. It's me practicing detachment. One of the characteristics of someone like Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Sumedho, is that very down to earth, very straightforward, uncomplicated. They are embodying that quality of awakened awareness, but like Lumpur Cha would say, live simply, be natural. It's not sort of trying to be in any kind of special, super mindful, aware, detached state, because then there's the mind holding on to an idea of it and then is born into that idea. I often tell the story that this fellow who was part of a Buddhist group here in England, and he was very, very sincere, and he was asking this question about how he could maintain his practice in his daily life. He was actually a police officer with a young family, and he said, you know, Ajahn, it's really tough. I'm trying to be mindful, but my family give me all this grief. And I said, why is that? You know, I thought maybe they're sort of devout Christians or there's some other kind of issue. He says, well, like, you know, I'm trying to be mindful, but they keep saying, you know, hurry up, Dad, we've got to get the bus. And I said, when you say being mindful, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, like at breakfast time, I want to make my tea in a mindful way. So I'm very aware of picking up the milk bottle, and I could just sort of see this kind of scenario happening, and these two teenage kids going, Dad, will you stop being mindful? Come on, we've got to get the bus, you know. We want the milk for our cereal as well. So very sincere. I'm not trying to belittle him, but very sincere. But he'd taken mindfulness, or this kind of cultivating this mindful awareness, as doing everything sort of hyper carefully, and in, you know, everything very, very slowly and super deliberately. Where if you're around someone like Lumpur Cha, that kind of naturalness and sort of ease in every situation was one of the most. I didn't spend a lot of time around him. Lumpur Pasana was many, many years in close proximity, and I had a much less contact. But just seeing how he functioned, it was like, live simply, be natural. It's like extremely straightforward and ordinary and uncomplicated. But there was that quality of presence and attention to what was going on. Lumpur Cha was incredibly observant. He, you know, noticed everything going on around him, but he wasn't sort of doing everything in slow motion or in a hyper careful or sort of ultra deliberate way. So that is a point. The idea of awareness is not awareness. That genuine attunement of the citta, the heart, to the present reality is what we would mean by awakened awareness. We can take the idea of it, or be the memory of it, and hang on to the idea or the program, but be missing the reality, not being aware of that your kids are getting really annoyed with you. If you're being really mindful, you'd speed up a bit and just do things at a more natural pace. So any other questions, thoughts, comments? Yes.
Really glad you brought up that topic. I've got high energy naturally, and people a long time just go, oh, you speak fast, you walk fast, you must be anxious on edge. And it's such a myth. You can be quite the opposite. You can be a slow person, seeming really relaxed, but your mind can be racing and not mindful at all, but quite the opposite. And a good example is like a marathon runner. Mm-hmm. They're running professionals at 13 miles an hour for 2 hours. They're extremely mindful. So I'm glad you said that mindfulness speed is very possible. Your voice talking fast and your movements of your body doesn't mean your mind is not relaxed as well.
In Ajahn Mahabua's monastery, I believe the basic ethic is eat fast, walk fast, Be mindful.
Basically.
But on the arms round, you really have to be quite fit to keep up, apparently. It's quite a scurry.
Send the address.
Yeah. Be quiet, be fast, be mindful. Not that then being quick is intrinsically mindful. That's Ajahn Mahabua's style, is go for it. He's a speedy, energetic character. He's passed away now, but that was very much a characteristic of his own nature. And that was the tone of his monastery. Be fast, be quiet, be mindful. Also, speaking about runners, Joseph Campbell, who was a well-known author, psychologist, mythologist, and notable philosopher, I would say, he was also an Olympic-class runner. There was a series of interviews with him in years gone by a man called Bill Moyers. And in the interview, he asked him if he'd had any kind of mystical experience. He wrote about religion and spirituality and mythology so much. And he said, yes, I have. But you'd be surprised to hear it was on the running track. He never ran in the Olympics. He peaked sort of between two Olympics. But he was like a world-class half-mile runner. And he described how his university was competing against one other university. And they had the half-mile relay, so four runners each doing half a mile. And he was the anchor. He was like the fourth runner for his university team. And when he got the baton, the runner for the opposition was 60 or 70 yards ahead. And he said, even though he was way behind when he got the baton in his hand, he said, as it landed in my hand, I knew this was my race. And his mind went into this extremely quiet, still state. And he ran the race of his life, and he won. But internally, it was in this extraordinarily quiet, still place, as his body was running the race of a lifetime. And I feel like that's a really interesting example, that the world, the external world, can be extremely active, but the mind which is aware of it can be utterly clear and still, and even as all that activity is going on. That's one example. And then it sort of stuck in his memory and was a significant point in his life as a major spiritual experience. Just happened to be running at great speed while it was taking shape. I'm not expecting everyone to start running around. It's not the running that makes a difference. It's the mind is what matters. So any final comments, questions, thoughts? Yes.
I have a question from yesterday. You comment about the experience of the world we experience is all conditional based on our previous conditions. So how can we be possible to reach the world beyond our experience?
Well, in a way, beyond is also prior to. Talking about insight meditation, that's really what that's about, is the word beyond tends to mean sort of off in the distance, but in a way the beyond is sort of the quality of the heart that's closest. So that getting beyond the world of experience is training the heart, like in this very moment, to know, oh, here is the feeling of the body sitting in a chair, the sight of the sala here at Amravati with the people gathered together, the sound of my voice, the choice of words coming together. So the mind that knows all of that in the sensory field, it doesn't have to be limited by that or identified with the words I'm speaking, even as they're being spoken. The word beyond, you can also use prior, P-R-I-O-R, that it's where experience is not being given a place to land, like in that dialogue of the Buddha with Kevada, where long and short and coarse and fine and pure and impure find no footing. So when we talk about the beyond, it can seem like something far away, but it's in a way closer to us than we are to our own personality. So this quality, this knowing quality of the heart, in a way, that's what is beyond the world. It's where the world ends. And then when the Buddha said to Rohitasa, it's impossible to reach the end of the world by walking, but I tell you, unless you reach the end of the world, you won't reach the end of dukkha. So where does the world end? It ends in this awareness. The end of the world is here. There. I would say when we reflect on where the world ends, it ends in awareness, because it's in awareness that knows the empty nature of the world. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching are patterns of consciousness arising and passing away. So the world ends not by exploding or the four elements evaporating, and that's not the end of the world, but the solidity, the substantiality of the world ends in awakened awareness. Enough for today. Let's leave it there.